Alright, it's me, and I want to thank everyone at the Oasis Podcast, as you were.
To the first ever episode of the Rain Podcast, where we're talking rock, alternative and indie music news. And joining me today, as always, it's the star of the show and the man who knows so much about indie music, he makes Alan McGee look like Alan Partridge. It's Richard.
Well done. Well done, mate. Was that completely off the cuff?
First time. Well done. Well done.
That was very good. Yes, thank you for this. So yeah, this is a new venture for James and I. Sorry, I'm Richard. This is the, as I say, the rock, alternative, indie music podcast. What we're going to do is, rather than, as we normally do, and the chance that I might veer off into that on many occasions anyway, rather than just talk about Oasis, we want to talk about contemporary music in a little bit more detail. So this was partly inspired by an article in The Guardian that says, you know, once you kind of hit your 30s recently, once you hit your 30s, you don't listen to new music, which I personally completely disagree with. I'm always kind of looking for new music, and by that I don't mean new bands, but I mean new music by acts that we've grown up with, you know, that long heralded interest in. You know, for example, if the Charlatans are releasing new music, I'll always keep a listen out for that, you know, and further back as well, for those that, you know, kind of formed our music opinions, be it, you know, the Beatles, not that they released much new stuff, but, you know, 60s acts that they kind of that are still going or still got things of interest. And the show is kind of designed to be a bit of a magazine show. Just catching up with the week's news, really, whether it be new singles, talking points, maybe even podcasts, reissues, that sort of thing. Just kind of give a bit of a one-stop shop overview for those of our generation, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really like the idea of, you know, we did discuss calling this the NME podcast, the New Music Experience, because that's something that I used to use the NME for. I would buy the NME every week. And part of that was, it was like my newspaper. I would be finding out what was going on, who Oasis had had a feud with that week, what was the new albums. And yeah, it's still out there, but I find that a lot of what was the traditional music press has either disappeared, or it's online and it's still out there. But there's so much now has got mixed in with pop music and hip hop and dance and films and TV, and it's all merged. And it's like, well, hold on, well, where'd you go if you're not really bothered about Stranger Things? You know what I mean? Like, because if I don't necessarily want to read the NME to read about Stranger Things, if I want to read about that, I'll go and read a TV blog. You know what I mean? So for me, it was like, well, I think there's a real hole here for people that love their rock, alternative, indie guitar music, and want to hear about that. So yeah, this is it.
Yeah, definitely. Is that, yeah, you know, it's a consequence of the Spotifyification, isn't it, of music? and you know, genres mean nothing anymore, and everything's kind of all in one big melting pot. And as you say, you know, the NME was the Bible for people like us in the up until it stopped, really, up until before it came free, until in 2015, it was kind of still the Bible for us. And then, as you say, it kind of came a free newspaper and specialised in nothing. You know, it's got stuff about, you know, I'm all for looking about a bit of pop culture, about Stranger Things or films or whatever, but, you know, I don't have any interest in games, you know, for example, where they've got a big push on games. It's like, well, what's your specialism? What's your kind of niche area? And like you say, you know, and especially nowadays with the real the kind of death of the music press, as it were, you know, but another reason this is partly been inspired by Ted Kessler's book about former editor of Q, used to work for the NME, subtitle is How I Destroyed the Music Press. It's basically how there's no real magazines anymore, you know, literal physical magazines. You've got Mojo, but that kind of cases for an older audience, as does Uncut. Kerrang's very specialist. You know, there's no queue, there's no enemy, you know, there's no real, there's kind of lower scale, but lower like fanzines, but they haven't got necessarily got the output. So yeah, as you say, it's kind of like there's a gap in the market to talk about the music we love, and we can't just be us, can it? You know, there's going to be other people that are going to still be interested. I mean, you see this, you know, for example, to shamelessly blow my boast, I saw the Chemical Brothers on Saturday at All Points East, and yes, they're an electronic act, but they are, you know, they have been going for 30 years. The crowd was quite, well, it was quite a diverse crowd, but it was still people of our age going, you know, and they're still a relevant interest. I know also they're not rock, but they're alternative, and there's still there is still a market, as it were, for acts like that to talk about them and you know, find out, discuss a little bit more in details about their newer stuff and what they've been up to since you know the last 10-20 years. So yeah, thought it'd be a good outlet for that. So yeah, here we are.
So there we go. Did you want to start off? Actually, that's a good place. So you were at the All Points East Festival, yeah? How was that?
Yeah, it was good. I mean, it was a bit weird one because it was day two. I think it's like the 6 or 9 day marathon is the All Points East Festival, but it was officially field day. Now, I don't know if you heard of field day, but that's like it's gone. It's been about, it was a festival, a 1 day festival that was running for about 15 years or has been running for about 15 years. And it kind of struggled to specialise. It used to be in East London in Victoria Park. And I remember when we went there about 10 years ago and we saw Franz Ferdinand there and Savages and Sleigh Bells. Then it became a bit more electronic and went up to Enfield. Now it seems to have gone, now it's kind of amalgamated. It's gone electronic, but it's back in its original venue, but it's under the umbrella of All Points East, so it's all a bit odd. I don't understand it. But yeah, so that was, it was the electronic day. So it was, I mean, the main reason I wanted to go was to see Kraftwerk, who, you know, are a real legendary act. I was actually supposed to go and see them at the same festival back in 2020. They were headlining along with, I think, Iggy Pop and Johnny Marr were supposed to be playing. But obviously, it will not happen in 2020, so it didn't quite happen. So I've always had that in the back of my head of like, well, I want to see them. And then also during the first lockdown, Florian Schneider passed away. So I got a lot more into Kraftwerk and kind of investigated a lot more and with the time on their hands, started listening a lot more and really got into them. So yeah, wanted to see them. And they were, you're always reluctant. I always find when seeing the kind of the older band, it's always like, oh, are they going to feel that? How are they going to work that stage? Is it going to work? And then you realise that that these are professionals that have been doing it for 50 years. You know, they know exactly what they're doing. And it was a 3D show as well. So everyone was kind of handed out 3D glasses. And it was quite an amusing sight to see everyone, the whole crowd was wearing 3D glasses. You know, obviously at a festival, stupid glasses are 10 a penny. But to see everyone in that environment wearing 3D glasses was good. And it was brilliant. Like the visuals were a bit simple, but still great. You know, while the four members of Kraftwerk just stood with a podium each and just played the music and just let the music do the talking. So it was brilliant, but I think the one issue I had with it, and this is potentially down to the location, it was a very mixed crowd, and there were quite a lot of middle-aged kind of families there, and I heard a lot of European accents, understandably, yeah, they being a German band. There's also a lot of East London rave heads, and I think they were just there waiting for, if you'd excuse the horrible expression, they're waiting for bangers that never happened, you know, bangers that never came. And I think, mercifully, the crowd kind of thinned out a little bit, which is good because, frankly, so a lot of these people are idiots. They're talking people who are talking during the gig. And, you know, Kraftwerk's music is very ambient. It's very atmospheric. It's also quite electronic, but it's lots of it's quite soothing, quite soft. And the last thing you want is people yabbering in their ears about how wasted they are, man, and how many drugs they've done. When you actually want to sort of sit and enjoy something like this, because also Kraftwerk don't tour often. You know, I think they're old men. I think there's always rumours it might be their last tour. So it was well worth it. Brilliant day. It was as the sun was setting, so it was quite a picturesque kind of day. And well worth the travels to London, even strikes and all. Thank you. It was well worth it.
Awesome. And what about the Chemical Brothers headlining as well?
I mean, again, similar kind of thing. Absolute professionals will know exactly what they're doing. Where Kraftwerk's visuals were quite sedate, and it was, you know, a lot was around kind of their album art, their various albums artworks. Chemical Brothers was a lot more of a, it was like an onslaught, really. They were on the main stage as well, so they had bigger screens to play with. But it was just, I mean, it was the things with electronic music as well. They kind of, you know, threatened to play a lot of tunes, like, you know, they did the lyrics to Coming On Strong, as we know it. But then they didn't play the song, so you kind of get lured back into it. But then we know it's another great tune they've got as well. I mean, yeah, they're open with block rocking beats. And with them as well, there's always ones you forget. You know, for me, it was they played a track called Wide Open, which they did with Beck 5 years ago, I think it was 2015. And that's another one you go like, oh, forget how much you like that one. And
yeah,
and yeah, there's a kind of full of surprises. And yeah, like I say, a supremely confident and professional headline set.
Excellent. Well, I also saw some musical performances this week. This may surprise you, as I go to a lot less gigs than you, Richard. But I was at Butlins this week, and I watched the Roller Boys, which was a which is a boy band, but they also wear roller skates. They performed on Britain's Got Talent a few years ago, and they were pretty crap. They just did like covers of Bruno Mars and stuff like that. To be fair, actually, I jest, but it was exactly what you want for the kids. They absolutely loved it. And the one of the members was one of the performers in the Michael Jackson Thriller West End show, and they did a Michael Jackson song, and it's like, this guy is great. Like, why is he not just doing a Michael Jackson tribute act? Why are we watching these guys sort of swing around on roller skates doing Bruno Mars? But anyway, it was good fun for what it was. And interestingly, there was a night called Superstar DJs, and obviously with Butlins, what they kind of do is they know that it's the parents who book the events that they're going to go to. So there's quite a few that were like, oh, Superstar DJs. And so we're like, oh, brilliant. That'll be Chemical Brothers, Fatboy Slim. Excellent. That's great. And we booked it. And it's like, they would like play a little bit of that, but then really it was just like a cheesy karaoke show doing modern dance stuff, you know, doing Calvin Harris and all this modern stuff. And it's like, okay, I see what you did. You call it something that hooks the parents, and then you just play cheesy crap for the kids, which is fine, you know, which was a... You know, this stuff is well put together to appeal to the kids. So yeah, as I say, so one of those times I can match you this week. I have been to live performances, although maybe not quite as cool as Kraftwerk and their Chemicals.
Well, music is music. You know, who we to judge? I mean, yeah, I'm not sure I'd swap, but gigs are gigs. You know, they all count, and you know, it's all entertainment, isn't it? At the end of the day.
Exactly. Right, should we talk about some music then? So
let's.
So there's been some... So I suppose an interesting one, that big Coldplay just headlined Wembley. Mm. And yeah,
had six some very, nights.
Was it six?
Six nights, yeah.
Jesus wept. Yeah, and had some bizarre guest stars. I take it you weren't there.
No. Do you know what I mean? I'll defend Coldplay because, I mean, they have settled into a rhythm probably for the last 10 years and four or five albums of like having something that's vaguely interesting as an album. I think it was Ghost Stories was as you know, it started at Milo Zarlota, which was all like big, brash, glittering kind of pop music, which still had some good songs on it. And then they went to do, I think the following one was Ghost Stories, the more intimate acoustic. And it was about Chris Martin's breakup with Gwyneth Paltrow. And then they went back to the big glittering pop one, and then they did another interesting one. And now they're back. They've kind of got this. It's like they push themselves forward to experiment a little bit, and then they go, actually, no, we've got like the crowd pleasing stuff. And they're in the midst of that at the minute. I mean, when I saw them in 2009, they had a mock up video of Simon Cowell judging them, like you would on Pop Idol. So they're not averse to crowd pleasing antics. But yeah, some of the guests that were on. I mean, who they had this week? They had Chasney Lewis doing a couple of All Saints tunes, fair enough. A bit random, but fair enough, because I think they did Pure Shores, which is a great tune. And Natalie Imbruglia doing Torn, and then did a tribute with to Olivia Newton-John. And I think they did, what do you remember the song they did? I think it was
Summer Nights.
What was it? Okay. And then the best one, I think we can both agree, was Alan Partridge last night.
Yeah. I hadn't clocked this until you mentioned it preparing for today. And I'm a massive Partridge fan, as I know you are as well. And one of the things that I've loved for years is the Partridge Kate Bush medley on Comic Relief that he did a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. I know it off by heart, you know, and it's almost a shame because I love Kate Bush, and in our house, you know, we love Kate Bush, but there's certain Kate Bush songs that Partridge medley is so ingrained in my memory. I really have to kind of push it out to not sing along in that, in that Partridge way at any of those Kate Bush songs. But then, yeah, so it was brilliant to see. Although I do have to wonder, like, for the, you know, thousands of people there that didn't know that Steve Coogan had done a Kate Bush medley as Partridge, you know, they must have thought, why is Alan Partridge doing Kate Bush? You know, it seems a bit bizarre, but yeah. And you know what, to be fair, Steve Coogan, brilliant singer, you know, he really does. He can hold a tune, you mm-hmm. know, it's not a difficult song to sing because he sings it in a relatively low register. But I think he did brilliantly, but to not just be able to sing in tune, but then also, like, you know, he's performing it as the character as well. Mm. And I didn't find it cheesy. I thought it was good fun. And if I only could, I could deal with God. And then it is well, and you say, you're running up that road, you're running up that hill, running up that hill all day.
I think, yeah, I think I agree with the Comic Relief thing. That was kind of, I had a similar thought. I was like, I remember him doing this. But I suppose because of Kate Bush's, running up that hill specifically, his ubiquity over the course of the summer, it's now become top of the list. I mean, like, that's the success of running up that hill because of Stranger Things. It's like obscene. It's like number one for like 2 or 3 weeks. It's,
yeah.
You know, I don't even know the streams it's got. It's made Kate Bush some like 2 million for nothing. So I suppose it's kind of topical. Bit that I love. I mean, I agree that Steve Coogan's good, but I think the best bit for me was the fact he was wearing a Snow Patrol jacket.
Yeah. Yeah,
that was great. That to me is just like, and it's not to go off on a tangent, but it's like with this time, it's like the attention to detail for some of the sneaky little gags and stuff and stuff like that is so good. And do you know what? Hats off to Coldplay, you know, for allowing that. I mean, one thing you can say about them is they don't take themselves seriously,
yeah,
in any way, shape, or form, and they know what they are, and they're fully given into it. So. Yeah, if I'd have been there, I'd have loved it. Because like you, I love Partridge. But yeah, gone are the days where they were important, they were a relevant rock band, I've got to say. But like I say, you know, they know it and they play along and it's entertainment, isn't it? It's mainstream entertainment.
Yeah, exactly. And it's you know, yeah, very positive and stuff, and I'm sure it'd be a great show. Going back, there's something I said on Twitter the other day, we were talking about Coldplay. I don't know how it came up actually, but I've mentioned that I've mentioned this on the Oasis podcast as well. I did see Coldplay. I've only seen them once, and that was on the first album tour when I was at university in Leicester at the De Montfort Student Union. And at the time, I think it was my final year. So this is like 2000, 2001. And by that point, I had a guy in the bar, we had a guy in the door, we had a guy, you know, a mate of mine was roadieing. And you could just get free tickets, you know, free, you could just get free whatever you want. We worked in a radio station as well. So I got like, you know, you could sort of blag backstage to interview people. I interviewed the Blue Tones and a few other people. And it was like, do you want to go see Coldplay? Yeah, okay then, you know, nothing else to do. Fine, let's go down and see this band Coldplay. And then I saw them, you know, it's probably in front of, you know, I don't know, 500 people or something. And it was good. It was a good show, but I wasn't bothered. I was sat at the back, you know, lagging free drinks from the bar from my mate Northern Irish Robert, who worked behind the bar, and I just remember turning to my mate and saying, "Yeah, they're decent, but they won't get any bigger than this." And Shows what I know about music, doesn't it?
You're the right man to do this podcast, really.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I'll be spotting those new bands all over the place. But no, I love, to be honest, I love the first album. I think it's brilliant. Second album, I think it's got a lot of good stuff on it. And then, to be honest, I turned off after that. I've heard all the singles. I've kept in touch with them. And some of them are, you know, I really liked, you know. But yeah, they've sort of reached that point. It feels like, I don't know if it's cynical, but it feels like they know how to do this so well that they just, they put this stuff together that just works really, really well. And it feels a bit of a, I don't know, it feels like they're cheating. Does that make sense?
I know what you're saying. It's quite interesting. I was chatting with my friend about this the other day, and I mean, they stole it from Arcade Fire, but I was, not through choice, 3 weeks ago, I went to go watch Sam Fender. Now, Sam Fender, do you know what? Good luck to him. I like, to quote Morrissey when talking about Robbie Williams, I like everything about Sam Fender apart from the music and the voice. No, the songs and the voice. I mean, mainly because I'm not a big Springsteen fan. It's just, it's fine. But I like his ethics, like the fact he writes his own songs, like his, you know, political stance, good on him. But his two biggest songs, Hypersonic Missiles and 17 Going Under, they've both got pretty much the same refrain, which is, something like that. And it's Coldplay. It's lifted from like Viva La Vida. And in what you kind of think, and cynical is the word for me, that the producers have obviously, with Sam Fender, have obviously gone, right, you need something like that to get the crowds going. And that dates back from when Coldplay did it for Viva La Vida. Probably like, the crowds love singing this for that song. And then, you know, and since then it's become a staple. It gets, you know, the Killers do it, you know, lots of other people. It's a big crowd pleasing moment kind of thing. Yeah. And yeah, I think since probably then, I think Coldplay's first three albums, third one's got some good stuff on it. Funny enough, at Kraftwerk, when they did Computer Love, that got a huge reaction, largely probably the fact because Coldplay nicked the sample for Talk. Which is on that third album. But yeah, similar to you, first album's great. I personally prefer the second, but they're both great. And like I said, it depends on the third stuff, but yeah, after that, it's diminishing returns. But they put on a hell of a show. You know, it's always entertainment. When I saw them at Glastonbury in 2016, you know, it was cheesy as you like, and they brought out Barry Gibbs, who's Staying Alive and stuff like that. But when you're in the moment, it's good fun. And that's all it is. You know, that's all it should be treated as, to be honest. It's just fun pop music. I think the days when they tried to be the next U2, a serious rock band, are long gone, and so be it.
Absolutely cool. All right, do you want to talk about some new releases?
Yeah, well, let's. I mean, obviously, I say obviously, but because I'm across the kind of the music a little bit better than you, I've sent you some homework. I mean, of the homework I sent across to you, of the singles, is there anything kind of particularly that you stood out, do you say? I mean, I sent you, you know, a list of about 8 to 10 tracks.
Yeah, so we've, I really like, so there's a new Reverend and the Makers tune called Heatwave in the Cold North, which I really like. It's got the sort of like, you know, it's a laid back kind of summer vibe, and it's quite, it's sort of knowingly kind of Marvin Gaye, Barry White-ish, which I'm cool with. You know, it's just, I like it when bands try and do something a bit different. You know, and he's, you know, he's old Rev is a very good songwriter, and he's done a lot of good stuff over the years, under the radar, pretty much. You know, obviously they had their big breakthrough with Heavyweight Champion, and since then it's sort of, you know, they've consistently put out decent stuff, but never really, you know, hit the mainstream again. And I really like this. I think it's got a vibe. It kind of reminded me of like the Beck, Midnight Vultures kind of era. You know, he does tunes like Deborah and stuff like that. Yeah, where it's like a rock band just tries to do that kind of, you know, sleazy sort of, you know, slow funk tune. I thought it was great.
Such a fella, there's no found happiness. I don't ever want to move. If I'm honest, I was glad you'd offer to be with me in the afternoon. I wanna write you an ode to fidelity. Blow smoke rings, we can do whatever you wanna do. I guess I'm loath to resist anything you might choose.
Yeah, I always keep an eye out for the Reverend Makers, because yeah, similar to you, like Heavyweight, well, The State of Things was obviously the breakthrough album, and that had some good stuff on it, and did a lot of work with Alex Turner as well on that album, which I think kind of gave him a bit of a G up. But then they had an album out in 2015, which might have been their last album, actually, called Mirrors. In fact, no, it wasn't the last album. Death of the King was the last album. But Mirrors in 2015, as a masterpiece. Oh, there's some great stuff on it, like a track called Black Widow, which is like this kind of psych rock tunes, which is brilliant. This one, yeah, similar to you, it's yeah, it knows what it is. It's a very kind of, almost tropical kind of blissful summer vibes with it, and yeah, a good perfect single. I'm not gonna say it's the best thing that I've done, but it's yeah, very pleasant and very likable. And yeah, I mean, the Rev is, you know, one of the good guys, you know, so the more power to him, and yeah, I don't know if it's like the precursor to an album or what. It's just, yeah, it's nice to hear from him again. It was also nice to hear it on Six Music the other day, like Stephen Matt kind of played it on his opening of his show, so it's, you know, it's nice to see him get a bit of an airplay as well, because he's mentioned on Twitter quite a lot that he's not sure how to promote his music. You know, he's very in touch with the fan base and quite on knowingly and honestly DIY. So yeah, I think to hear that getting played on the radio is heartening. And yeah, like I say, one of the good guys. And yeah, it's just a bit of a not throwaway single, but yeah, certainly very pleasant. Yeah, good fun.
Yeah, a bit of fun for the summer. Although he did say, like, you know, they put it together and it was absolutely blisteringly hot, and then they released it and it was like, actually, then it started pissing down. So yeah, that's just suits. Yeah, sums it up, doesn't it?
He does live in Sheffield. I mean,
yeah. Well, yeah, understandable. one of the other ones that jumped out to me was, I think it's probably worth discussing, is DMAs are back. Mm-hmm. New song called I Don't Need to Hide. And similar to what we're talking about with Coldplay, you know, to just say, I've never been a huge DMAs fan, and they get a lot of press and stuff in the Oasis fandom world, because they kind of, you know, they've sort of, they're openly Oasis fans and they've supported Liam and things like that. I've never really thought they were very good. I saw them support Liam, thought they were okay, nothing special. And this, I think this suffers from kind of this modern sort of issue that a lot of indie bands, you know, in inverted commas, have got, where it's like they're trying to do sort of big anthemic pop, you know, with dance elements sound, to appeal to the, you know, to sort of a mainstream audience, get that big pop single. And I just thought, ugh, I just couldn't be doing with it, to be honest. I think he's got a very, very good voice. You know, I've always rated the guy's voice, and this suits his voice perfectly. But anthemic pop is just not for me, and I'd much rather have a bit more, you know, down and dirty in my indie music.
I know what you mean. I struggle with them sometimes. Sometimes they are capable of good stuff. But yeah, it's kind of like 80s electro pop. And when they kind of list their cite their emphasis and stuff, it was, yeah, the emphasis on the pop. But yeah, when they cite their emphasis, it's like British rock bands. And you kind of think, well, yeah, you don't necessarily sound anything like them, which is fine, you know, but it seems an incongruous one. I mean, I've only listened to it once, so perhaps it'll grow on me. But yeah, I know what you mean. They have done some really good stuff, but I think you have to be in the right mood for them. I think if you're kind of you know, chilling out, or frankly, if it's a sunny day, or if you're maybe a little bit downtrodden, then I think you kind of hit the right spot. But I think if you're not, it kind of washes over you a little bit. I mean, the lead singer is an Everton fan, so I'll forgive him that. but yeah, I think it might have the potential to be a grower, as they say, that one, and we'll see. But yeah, I know what you mean. It didn't stand out.
Yeah, no, and I think it's always difficult when people are talked about, like, as, oh, the new Oasis, or the new, you know, oh, this is the next one. And they had that billing for a couple of years, and I just couldn't hear it. You know, I just thought, well, they're fine. But, you know, this is not, I just didn't think they were that special. And yeah, and I say in this one, so I always look out for them. Okay, well, they've got the talent. Is this going to be the one? But I think this, as I said, this suffers from, you know, I'd be interested to see who the producer is. I couldn't see that on the credits so far. But yeah, but whether or not they have gone with a big pop producer to try and get that breakthrough, I don't know. But yeah, not for me, mate. And then what else we got? So yeah, so there's this new album by the Hull band Life. So this was a new one for me. I know this is, I think, their third album, and I hadn't listened to the previous ones. It's not a band I've seen the name before. It's a terrible name for a band. But yeah,
it's not the only ones either. There's a band in America called Life.
Yeah, there's an American band called Life as well, which is dreadful. But yeah, so this was a pleasant surprise. I thought it had, and it's interesting that we're going to come on to talk about an album that's got a 20th anniversary coming up, because I think there's definite sort of ties to that. Apparently, like reading about this album, this is them trying to write about Hull, which is their hometown. They're trying to summarize, you know, that, and they're trying to very much get that feel, which I didn't really get, to be honest. I mean, I didn't really dig into the lyrics significantly, but generally I found it very eclectic, but not necessarily in a good way. I think there were some tracks that had sort of a Franz Ferdinand-y kind of vibe, that sort of post-punk with like that disco sort of Franz Ferdinand sort of beat to them, which I really liked. Some more had that sort of Rich Hawley, you know. I think there's a couple of tracks they deliberately, you know, have sort of recorded like lower vocals and much more quieter, and I quite like those as well. But then there was some that I kind of found had that sort of insistent sort of post-punky kind of wiry vibe that just sort of annoyed me, to be honest. I was like, okay, I can kind of skip that one, you know. But then so it's a bit all over the place, kind of a I felt an album of kind of three parts, and two thirds of it I really liked, but then some of it I could have just kept, or, you know, take it or leave it.
I lay awake at night and angst about my phone to rip. I think about Lorraine, the lady on the phone. Do you feel your package suits you? I don't feel anything at all. I slept in late today, and yes, I slept in yesterday. I think I'm spending far too much on fairly average takeaways. You feel you've got a problem. I don't feel anything at all. Don't go to Big Moon Lake, they said. It'll only blow your mind. Come to the Yorkshire Dales instead. You know it's half the price. I'm freaking out.
I'm very familiar with their first two albums, and funny you say about the kind of post-punk thing. The first two albums are a lot more what is now defined as post-punk, because it's a kind of ragged rock, like kind of raggedy rock kind of punk indie stuff. It was a lot more, I don't want to say generic, but it was a lot more familiar. This one is actually a bit of a step on in terms of their kind of songwriting capacity. And it's interesting what you say about the kind of eclecticism of it, but that's maybe them trying to demonstrate it. For example, you know, Friends Without Names is a real kind of broadening of the sound, and it's based around kind of guitar licks and much more expansive than perhaps they've done before. I personally think that song's great. I know what you're saying. There is kind of an element of like throwing a lot at it, but and this is a kind of consequence of the way I kind of listen to it. I think that will probably be a grower, because it doesn't. I think you're different to me in that you probably get things quite quickly, whereas I'm the opposite. It takes a while to get under my skin, and I've only listened to it a couple of times. But I think there's some real gems in there. I mean, for example, I think Duck Egg Blue, I think has the potential to kind of be a lodge itself in its head, really. Similar with Drug, which is a track I really like. But I know what you mean. It's currently kind of looking to be based around their hometown. I think maybe a lot of it was a little bit too personal in that respect. I think that's the kind of the risk you run of sometimes bands making it. Yeah, maybe it's such a universal concept, isn't it? Band looking to run away from their hometown, so looking to move on or critiquing it. And I imagine if you're based in the northeast, in a northeast coastal town, you get a lot more from it than perhaps we do in the south of England. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, so I didn't really hear in the lyrics like you know, I think there was a couple of references I thought, oh, okay, that's, I've noticed something there. But whether or not in the lyrics he says, you know, oh, I go down to the chip shop on a Friday night, or, you know, what, I don't know if there was those specifics. I mean, I always loved, you know, some in the Arctic Monkeys, the debut album especially, they really felt like, you know, you could really hear this was a night out in Sheffield, you know, whereas, you know, you're not from New York City, you're from Potter's Bar, and like, you know, mentions of Rotherham and the riot van winding the cop, you know, all that sort of stuff. It really felt like, you know, you were there, you could envisage it, which I didn't necessarily get from this, but maybe it's, you know, as I said, that I've only listened to it through a couple of times. So yeah, maybe it's in there, but yeah, no, generally I did think there was definitely a lot in there. Have they got two singers, or is it just, the one guy with two different styles?
I think they're only listed as one singer. I think Mez Green's the name. Right. Yeah. I think he's only listed as one. When did I see them live? I saw them live a few years ago now before the pandemic. I forget. Yeah. I mean, they're a four piece, but yeah, I think maybe someone does if you've got a lot backing vocals, the BBs or additional, but officially only one guy, Mez. Yeah.
No, it's just at times it felt like a big shift in the vocal style. I wasn't sure if it was actually two singers, but anyway, no. So it's good album, and I will sort of try and catch them live, because I can imagine it'd be a really good live performance.
Mm. Yeah, very entertaining.
My life was twisted, blurred and gone.
I suppose the big album that's come out recently in our rock alternative indie world is the Kasabian album. So this is the first one post Tom's departure. I saw Kasabian at Nebworth, which I talked about on the Oasis podcast. Is an incredible show. You know, there was the concern that with Tom gone, you know, and they didn't, you know, have a like for like replacement for him. So could Serge, you know, take that on and be the main star and be the front man? And I thought he did a fantastic job. I know when we talked to a couple of people that have, you know, that loved that dynamic of Tom and Serge together with Kasabian, they didn't quite feel as strongly, but I thought he did a fantastic job. And I suppose this is the first album as well that's sort of Kasabian without Serge. He's done his solo stuff as well, but yeah, what did you think of it?
I really like it. I mean, it's gone in at number one. It's their, I think, their sixth number one album, and this is their seventh album in total. Like you, I mean, I saw Kasabian back in October. I think when they were doing like some kind of warm-up show, well, not warm-up shows, kind of test the water shows for essentially for the new lineup, see how it was getting on without Tom. I do remember thinking at the time, you know, everyone's going, oh, it's not going to be the same band without Tom, and, you know, it's going to be rubbish. It's like, well, he is just the singer. And I don't mean that to sound like harsh, but, you know, he's not a Liam, you know, he's not got a once in a generation voice. You know, he's quite good at ging people up, but more and more it was becoming more quite noticeable, especially with the later albums. Like, it was basically, there were two co-singers. Like, Serge was doing backing vocals and harmonies for pretty much whole songs at a point. And in their live shows, he'd always do quite a few numbers. So I thought, well, it's not really that big a transition. And the power in Kasabian live comes from the bands. It didn't come from Tom. So I was like, I can see how that would work. And yeah, like yourself, I was like, yeah, to be honest, that's quite a seamless transition. I mean, as a front man, I think they're clearly kind of cut from the same cloth. I think Serge is a little bit more mobile. He kind of doesn't stay still. He's kind of constantly running around. So it's become a much more of a one-man show, but it was kind of 75% him anyway, I would have said.
Yeah.
So the album itself, it's good. Yeah, I do like it. I mean, there's a couple of great tracks on there. I think Rocket Fuel is going to sound like an absolute beast live. I think Chemicals is one of their great singles. But I have to say, they were the last album as well, For Crying Out Loud, back in 2017, I think wasn't quite as good as the previous ones had been. I think this kind of continues that now. I think they've had their imperial period, well, not their zenith, as it were. And I think they kind of started a downward turn. Well, not downward, well, yeah, a downward trail, I guess is probably a better way to say. On the last album, I think this kind of sustains it. It's a good album, but it's certainly nowhere near as good as West Pauper Bride Lunatic Asylum. Can never get that part around. which is still their ultimate. And I think it's good. But it's got pretty much everything you want from a Kasabian album. You know, I always think with Kasabian, like Muse, they're bigger than they should be. Do you know what I mean? Because they're kind of condemned as kind of lad rock, and that's just not true. You know, they're referred to as like a poor man's Oasis or whatever, but they're more like Primal Scream, I think, in terms of the experimentation, the sounds they use. You know, Serge is very, I think DJ Shadow is probably his biggest influence. He's always kind of, he's very into his breakbeat music and his electronic stuff, and he's a big fan of the Wu-Tang kind of stuff like that. And I think you can hear that a lot more. I think it's very diverse, and you always listen to it and go, I don't know how this goes with mainstream audiences, but obviously it does. It's a good album, not their best, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's that point about the sound and the Oasis comparisons. I think a lot of that was down to Tom, wasn't it? You got a guy swaggering, clearly influenced by Liam and swaggering around like Liam, you know, and it just filled that, you know, and it wasn't lad rock, but it was very masculine and aggressive. And a lot of those early singles as well had that swagger and power to them that while it wasn't, you know, it didn't sound like Ocean Colour Scene or you know other people that get lamped in with lad rock or like Solo Weller or whatever, it had a masculine energy to it that kind of ticked that box. So I suppose it's not exactly the same thing, but it had a lot of the similar elements. And yeah, I agree. I think from that track did really stand out, Rocket Fuel, as being like almost a Prodigy-esque. You know, I'm like, this could be a mid-90s Prodigy tune, but they've kind of carried on that similar vein throughout in recent years. So yeah, definitely had that kind of Prodigy feel to it. The quieter moments, I don't think, work as well. There was the tune that they played. I can't remember the name of the tune, but the one they played over the end of the women's Euro final. Yeah, The Wall. And I just think, I don't like it when they go quiet. I think, stick with the beats and the big upbeat tunes if you're Kasabian. When he sort of tries to make it more anthemic, I don't really think it works as well. I like stuff like Velociraptor and things like that. You know, that had just got a real fun, bouncy aggression to them. It's as I said, and it's he's clearly a very talented guy. What do you think of the it's SLP, isn't it? His solo stuff.
Yeah, the SLP is good. I mean, I think with that one, he was free to take a few more risks. And I think the one with Little Sims, I think is Favorite, I think it's called, is great. And there's a couple of other good ones off the album that were really good ones. Trance, I think, was a great one as well. A kind of like psyche, kind of electro ballad, again, quite kind of 90s electro kind of stuff. It was good. He's obviously taken those, quite fortuitous that it happened when it did, within a year before Tom left the band. So it was good for him that he had that kind of experience. But it's a hard one, really, because I guess he has to kind of write songs that fit that Kasabian mode so that you kind of get what you expect. But by the same token, he is the sole songwriter, and barring the first album, has only ever been the songwriter. I think Tom maybe did a handful of lyrics or something, or maybe wrote one or two songs, but it's always been him. So it's kind of like, well, why do you feel you have to kind of fit in that Kasabian mode? Why can you not break that? Or why is the SLP the album for that? So I suppose he's now got the kind of best of both worlds. But I know what you're saying about the ballads. Like, The Wall is, quite schmaltzy, I think is probably the word I would say. But then, you know, quite mainstream kind of pop and theme. Yeah, I was kind of thinking about it. Is that you must kind of look at that and go, well, yeah, it's not really us. But it would tick a certain amount of boxes in terms of, you know, a big arms aloft, kind of hands in the air ballads, which, you know, everyone, it's handy if you can write it, I guess. It's handy if you've got one. I'm like you, I'm like, it's not really for me. But yeah, that's the question. I thought, it's too early to say, but I maybe preferred the SLP to this album because it was a little bit more experimental, a little bit more off the wall. Come back to me in a couple of months.
Fair enough. Cool.
It's just a simple way.
All right. And then we always like to look at a reissue, a album that celebrated a big anniversary. And today, this week, we're 20 years of the debut Interpol album. Interpol, big band for you?
Not hugely. I was a little bit late to the party. I was more into the Strokes than the White Stripes at the time. So I was a little bit late to it. I kind of got into them in between two albums. So I kind of missed the impact. But you listen to it now, or indeed you listen to it at the time, and indeed the influence it kind of has. I mean, you know, early editors basically based their career on Interpol. Did you know, that interesting little tidbit of information, that the guitarist, Daniel Kessler, is brother of a former NME journalist and a former editor of Q, Ted Kessler, who wrote that book I mentioned earlier on.
Wow, I did not know that.
They were born in, well, they were brought up initially in the UK, and then when Ted was about, I don't know, 19, 20, I think it was in the book, the family moved to the States and he stayed here, and the younger brother went with the family, and then moved to New York. Yeah, random, because there's a thing in the book saying that our mate Alan McGee was slated in the music industry 20 years ago. So he's saying he's all incestuous, and like the only reason Interpol is big because of the family links. But like Ted Kessler kind of made a point of not listening to him because he didn't want to show too much favoritism, or B, think they were rubbish, and then have to pretend they weren't. Their kind of impact, yeah, as I say, it's quite pronounced. And yeah, 20 years is, I mean, you know, 25 years of all these anniversaries and from 97, it's equally as disgusting that the Turn Out the Bright Lights is 20 years old. But I think there's a few albums out there that deserve the kind of the praise that they get, and that's definitely one of them. They released like a little bonus making of documentary, and I think they've just released one of their early EPs called the Black EP, I think it is, in kind of commemoration. How about you? Big album for you?
No, not really. I mean, like I liked, you know, I was more Strokes and White Stripes at the time, the more the garage rock side of it, and then Jet and you know, Cooper Temple Claws were a big band for me around then, that sort of early 2000s. Interpol was more like I knew people that liked them, and then this album passed me by. I had to kind of remind myself that the first album wasn't the one with like Slow Hand and Evil and stuff on it, because that was the bigger one with the bigger singles. And so it's only sort of going back really. I'm like, oh right, oh, okay. So the one with Obstacle on it and stuff, that was an extra one. So this wasn't a big album for me at all. And they're just one of those bands that, yeah, for me it has been more their influence, you know, and you can hear as he's got a very, very distinctive voice. And it's like, if people know my views when I talk about Oasis, voices are a big thing for me. I'm a singer myself, and well, I wouldn't say singer, but you know, I have sang in a band before, and if I don't like your voice, I find it very difficult. And Paul Banks has got that very, very specific way of singing. And you know, and a lot of comparisons over the years to Joy Division, which I can kind of hear, but I think that's quite lazy, really. I don't think he does really sound like Ian Curtis. I think that's sort of close enough, and they generally got that kind of sound, but I don't really think he does sound like Ian Curtis. But he has got a very particular, I don't think the melodies are all kind of the same, but just the way he delivers them, I can kind of find it a bit samey. And you know, often it's, I just sort of, you know, the odd single here and there, I really, really enjoy. But anytime I've listened to albums over the years, after a while, the voice I find a little bit grating. But going back to this album, I was really taken aback, actually, how shoegaze it was. You know, I've always thought of them as being that sort of post-punk kind of, you know, and the chiming, jaggy guitars. Whereas actually there's a lot more sort of the more chiming guitars and sort of, you know, that kind of Las Vegas sort of had that sound later on, you know, sort of looking back to My Bloody Valentine, people like that. I'm like, oh, wow, I wasn't kind of expecting that, to be honest. There is definitely that element to them. I really, really like that. I think that's good. And maybe it's just because then the voice isn't quite as annoying. But as I say, it's like they're not one of my favorite bands, but and I think they've got a lot to answer for, because, you know, like we were talking about Coldplay earlier, the thousands of like average indie bands that came after Coldplay that have just taken that Coldplay kind of sound. And you could say the same for Interpol as well. There's so many bands that came out when people talk about that landfill indie scene. And I think that's a bit unfair. There was a lot of good bands in the mid-2000s. But yeah, a lot of them were very influenced by this band and this album.
Yeah, agree. I couldn't. Yeah, agree with that. I'd say they kind of the influence kind of carries on. And yeah, you can talk about the shoegazy stuff as well. I kind of noticed that. I listened to it a couple of weeks ago. I'm always more excited by the idea of Interpol than actually am listening to them. Do you know what I mean? When it's kind of announced they've got some new stuff coming out, like, okay, great. Can you listen to some new singles? And then you listen to it like, yeah, okay, yeah, it's all right, it's fine. You know, there are some exceptions. I mean, The Rover from 2018, I think it was a an outstanding single, but then similar when you kind of see them live, you just want more, I think, they're so cool, they've got everything, they've got, in theory, they've got every box ticked, they were a talented musician, had Carlos D's no longer there, they had, you know, cool people within the band, there was everything kind of set up right about them, but they just lack something for me. I think there's just that little bit of it's some kind of magic ingredient that I'm obviously missing out on, because they're huge, you know, they do stuff, they do tours and have good festival slots and things like that. But yeah, the idea in principle of Interpol is great. I, similar again, what I was saying earlier on, you have to be in the right group then to catch you like that. And that doesn't happen enough for me. What I would say is, though, there's some good stuff about them. Have you read the book Meet Me in the Bathroom by Lizzie Goodman? It's about the New York rock scene from, I think, 2001 to 2011. Well worth a read. There's quite a lot of good little tidbits about them there and how they've gone in circles. They moved in about that whole scene generally, obviously The Strokes being the main one. There's a documentary about it, which has been in the pipeline for a long time. I think it was at Sundance earlier in the year, but it's yet to come over here, which I think will be quite interesting. But I think they very, very much benefit from being associated with that scene, I think. All right, one other thing, I know we said we talk about podcasts, the really good podcast, I know I saw you big it up the other day, our friend Katie, who does the Sound Effects podcast, recently released an episode with Danny McNamara from Embrace, and really, really good stuff, like brilliant. You know, Katie's a trained psychologist and Danny just goes so in, and it's a really powerful listen, him talking about his various mental health issues over the years. But
you know, but in a really positive and powerful way. And you know, and it's a really well put together, you know, piece of entertainment as well, which is dreadful to say, but you know, Katie's edited it really well. And obviously she just knows. I'm always really inspired when I listen to how she does it, because as an interviewer, like, I sort of find myself, okay, ask a question, let them answer it, next question. Whereas, you know, she just knows, she'll just go, that's really interesting why you said that. I'd like to dig into that a bit more and things like that. And you go, wow, oh yeah, I should do that. You know, as a podcaster, I find that really inspiring. And yeah, and I thought the interview was excellent.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, yeah, the way Katie, I was listening to the episode myself recently, and I was kind of, she doesn't say much at all. Do you know what I mean? Every word she uses is powerful, but I guess it's obviously a training, but you know, she doesn't say much, but what she does say just invites so much conversation, invites so much dialogue from the person she's actually speaking to. It's very, like, it's obviously, I mean, obviously she's trained to do it, but you know, it's quite a skill that she has. And yeah, it was a really good listen. I mean, there, he made a point of saying that he wanted to speak more about mental health, and kind of, he was dealing with more that side of it in terms of interviews and stuff he was going to do, whereas other members of the band, I think Richard were going to do the actual, you know, the PR, the press stuff. I thought that was quite interesting. And it's encouraging, you know, that bands are seeking that out now, and actually looking to speak more about that, because, you know, obviously the thing about mental health is there's never enough conversation, there's never enough exposure to it, so the more the better. So it's good. I mean, that, and that kind of ties into their recent ethos of trying things differently, like with the Patreon and so on and so forth. It's good that they're, you know, thinking outside the box, as it were, and being creative with their ideas. And yeah, I mean, there's no better place to go to that than the Sound Effects podcast, where, yeah, as I say, you know, Katie says is really insightful and brings out the best, well, brings out a lot of people from people.
Yeah. Yeah, she interviewed me for it, and I was like, really, just talking about my life and my favourite music over the years and stuff. And yeah, I don't know how she does it, but it's just, yeah, she had me choked up a number of times, you know, and I'm like, wow, how does she do that? It's like a magic trick. But anyway, it's not like, you know, misery, what they call it, misery porn or whatever, where you just want to get people's, you know, I'm very aware of that. I've done a few episodes on the Oasis podcast where we talk about people that have had cancer and things like that, and you don't want to overdo that. You know, because it's good to have that occasionally. But if every episode is just, you know, sob stories, it's just too much. But I think, yeah, the way that, you know, it's very powerful, I think, for people to have heard that. Because, you know, like he explains in the episode, it was only a minor thing, really, that then basically completely changed his life. It was only like his car kind of got conked out in the middle of the motorway, basically. And they never actually had a crash. It was just the thought that he could have had the crash that kind of just knocked him sideways, and it really affected him. But yeah, so definitely check that one out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, couldn't agree more. It's well worth an hour, and I think it's an hour and a half of your time. If you've got a journey to go on and sometimes to lose yourself in a conversation, that's definitely one to pick out. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And I tell you what, should we also simulcast this? We'll chuck this in the Oasis podcast as well, because Be Here Now by Oasis has had its 25th anniversary. And I did an Oasis podcast breakdown of ranking all the tracks last week. You then came back and said, I disagree with everything you said or something, which I thought was quite rude. But anyway, what's your overview on Be Here Now, Richard, celebrating 25 years?
I mean, yeah, it's terrifying. I mean, as I say, for me, it came out the same day as our GCSE results. So we went into town and bought the album first before we got our GCSE results. You know, and that was a priority that I stand by to this day.
Absolutely.
Especially when I got the results through. I mean, it's hard to really kind of add much to what, because it's been a real kind of nostalgia fest over the last, kind of add much more to it. I mean, I went and listened to the Mustik demos a couple of weeks ago, or a couple of days ago, and I was thinking about what I would do to it, you know, to make it. But I was thinking about certain songs I'd like that you would trim to make it shorter, because that's his issue. I think with it is it's too long. I think the songs are great if they were shorter. There's some great melodies there, some really good lyrics on there, actually, some of Noel's best lyrics. It's just the excess. So, for example, I think, do you know what I mean? You could probably lose a minute of like the feedback and the noise at the beginning, but then by the same token, it's a big brawling monster that, you know, that's designed to be the big comeback. So therefore, would you want to trim from it? I don't know. Words. My Big Mouth, I think it's probably right. It was about 5 minutes. I think you could probably do that. Magic Pie, you don't need the solo, if you can call it that, and then the last verse takes it well over the 7 minute mark. You don't need that. You can scrap all that. But then again, some melody, and some good lyrics. Stand By Me, I mean, I've said my thoughts on this before. You just trim the choruses. Just make the first chorus the repeated line once, the second chorus the repeated line twice, and the last chorus made it three times. Rather than having it Stand By Me, Nobody Knows Where It's Going to Be, repeated three times, on three different occasions. Just trim it. But keep the middle eight, because that's beautiful. That's one of the best things they've ever done.
Yeah, nobody knows the way it's going to be. The way it's going to be, yeah. Maybe I can see, yeah. But don't you know the cold and wind and rain don't know. They only seem to come and go away.
Hope I Think You Know, perfect. Wouldn't touch that. Girl in Dirty Shirt, the bridges are too long, trim them. But again, some of the lyrics that are quite good. Fading Out, could do the trim. It's Getting Better Man, you don't need the chorus line repeated 33 times. But then music's really good, so you could probably just take out the, you know, the. Also, the thing on that as well, it's not It's Getting Better Man that repeated 33 times. It's We're Getting Better Man, but yeah. Repeated 33 times. It's a little bit too on the nose for me, I think. If you just remove the chorus, the singing from that, I think you'd be fine. Don't Go Away, perfect. Be Here Now, fine the way it is. All Around the World obviously goes on way too long, but that's the point of it. But even in what I've said, you keep the flagpoles, like, do you know what I mean? Fading Out and All Around the World, the same length, but trim something else. You still probably got 15 minutes taken off the album, which then would take it to what? 55 minutes.
55, yeah, which is a much more normal size album, isn't it?
Hmm.
Yeah.
So, yeah, in terms of actually being 25, like I say, it's. I mean, we're just at the kind of the end of the Oasis 25 years milestones, aren't we? I guess, you know, from Definitely Maybe Through to this, when you factor in Nebworth and More Glory and stuff. I think, you know, if they're starting to celebrate 25 years of the Masterplan next year, it might be scraping the barrel a little bit. It's not a huge amount to add to what everyone else says. You know, it was a moment in the album, as the title suggests. You either love it and you still do now, I guess.
Yeah, it's been interesting, like looking at the way it's been celebrated and stuff. I saw the Oasis people put a billboard up in Leicester Square. And it was like, whether it was a co thing with Spotify, because it's like Spotify, Oasis Be Here Now 25, and it's got the Liam and Noel faces from 1997. But it's weird because there's no reissue. The only thing they did was a bit of merch and a vinyl, but it's not like, it's like, you know, because they remastered it in 2016 with The Chasing the Sun. So it'd be a bit of a blag to remaster it again. And I think they already went through and got the Mustique demos and you know, a few of the live bits and stuff that they released in 2016. We know there is still more stuff out there, you know, that could have been put out, but I think that would have then meant, you know, Noel kind of dredging going through his old demos, or, you know, that he's probably not been asked to do. So, you know, there is more stuff out there that we know about that they could have done. And then you've actually got like a new product to say, oh, come and check it out. It's a true 25th anniversary extended edition. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was strange. Like, if you haven't got a new product, to then have a billboard up in Leicester Square, which is going to cost you thousands, right? I don't know how much it would cost, but a lot of bloody money. Mm-hmm. To then just say, come and listen to Be Here Now on Spotify, the same one that's been there for years. Like, I thought Spotify, you only get like 0.001p per click. Well, is that really going to be worth it to get, you know, I just thought that was a strange choice when you've not even got a new thing to put out with it. I would have loved a documentary. That would have been the thing for me. They've posted out little bits of videos and little bits of clips and things. And I know that they're talking about doing like a voice note project that people sent in voice notes. But yeah, I think a documentary for me would have been the thing to do.
Yeah, they've actually done the voice note project. It came out a couple of days ago. It's like a minute just of people sending in their voice notes. I guess new products, there kind of is because of that picture disc and the 25th anniversary stuff. So there is new, and there's a lot of new merchandise. But yeah, I know what you mean. There's no new version of it. I mean, what was also weird is that the Chasing the Sun edition came out 2 years after Decking in Glory, but still 1 year shy of the 20th anniversary. So that was like 6 years ago. So anyway, so that was a bit odd. Yeah, it is a bit funny one. I believe they are talking about, Noel kind of hinted he was doing something, some sort of thing, a video thing at some point this year. So that might be to tie in with it. I mean, but then it goes back to the thing that Noel really doesn't like being here now and therefore probably doesn't want much to do with it. It doesn't feel like it's worth celebrating, I guess. But yeah, everything's about anniversaries these days, isn't it? And everyone's kind of got this landmark. And I guess you also want to hold things back for the 30th anniversary. And, you know, the 30th anniversary reissue and so on and so forth. I guess they can't, you know, it's like with the Beatles. Always be doing another anniversary in which they're going to capitalise on. So yeah, it's a bit of playing a long game, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, no, fair enough. It's just a bit annoying. And I did ask on Twitter for people's favourite. You mentioned there about the lyrics being great. And I did ask for people's favourite lyrics from Be Here Now, because I think it is an excellent album for lyrics. And I think it's because I mentioned it on the last episode where we talked about, the fact that there's so much confidence in the lyrics, because it's like it's the first album he's written where he's then got money and he's got the success. So you've got all these lines that are just really, you know, really, really confident. But yeah, I asked for, let's give you some of these. So Hub said, "I met my maker and made him cry. And on my shoulder, he asked me why." Brilliant. You know, another one of Noel's classic sort of having a go at God or religion. Ollie Ford, "Your shit jokes remind me of Diggsy's." Dee Dee, "Listen up, man. They don't even know you're born." Mark Osborne, "Me and you, what's going on? All we seem to know is how to show the feelings that are wrong." And then we got Katie from Sound Effects, says, "Damn my education. I can't find the words to say." Followed by Touching Words, that said it just perfectly. Yeah, as I said, "Don't Go Away" is right up there, isn't it, with some of the best lyrical stuff he's done. Andy Middleton, "Kicking up a storm since the day that I was born." Anderson's, "No one could give me the air that's mine to breathe." Seller Woody, "Around this time you cease to be. That's what you get for sleeping with the enemy." Love it. What have we got? "Get up off the floor and believe in life," says Jack Adams. "If you ever find yourself inside a bubble, you've got to make your own way home." Oh, there's hundreds of people have sent in, but yeah, it's great. I love them.
I think the one I'd go for would be "You're trying to hide my place, and that is why I've got to keep running." I think that would be, that's the one that pops into my head straight off the bat. In terms of like classic Oasis defiance, I think that would be the one that kind of strikes the chord for me, I think, continuing the Oasis thing of being trapped in your surroundings, or indeed not being trapped in your surroundings and making a break for a better life. I think that's the one that sticks for me. But yeah, you're right, it's full of them. It's, yeah. And some clangers, you know, the Beatles references probably go a little bit too overboard. And what is the line in Fading Out? "Coming in out of nowhere, singing Rhapsody," like Noel, that's also biographical. I think Noel saying that he was thinking of "Live Forever" when he wrote "Live Forever," but that's the Rhapsody in question for that line. But I'm just thinking a lot of the others now. I think it was Bonet, you know, Bonet on the Right Here Right Now documentary says, you know, his lyrics have gone 100%, and that doesn't really get spoken about. We'll be right back.
right, brilliant. Well, thank you very much for listening to this first episode of the Rain podcast, the rock alternative and indie news. You can follow the podcast on, right, where is it actually? It's at the Rain Pod. What is it? It's at the Rain Podcast. R-A-I-N, mm-hmm. The Rain Podcast. Yeah. And yeah. So thank you very much, Richard.
No, listen, yeah, look forward to doing this a bit more regularly. And just to say this, that there's a few albums to come this week that I'll be giving you the homework. But on Friday we've got new albums from the Lounge Society, Muse, if you're so inclined to listen to that. But there's also obviously Reading Leeds Festival this week, so there'll be, which includes the return of Arctic Monkeys to the UK for us to talk about in the future or next week.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you very much, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks a lot, James.
The man who makes Alan McGee... Oh, fucking hell, I fucked it up. And joining me, as always, is Richard, the man who knows so much about indie music. He makes... Oh, fuck it, hell. And joining me, as always, it's the star of the show. It's the man who... Ah! Yeah, let's try and do it as live. It would be fine.
All right, go on then.
And joining me today, as always, it's the star of the show and the man who knows so much about indie music. He makes Alan McGee look like Alan Partridge. It's Richard.
Well done. Well done, mate. Was that completely off the cuff?
First time. First time.
Well done.